Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. This week's podcast is a recording of a live show that I do every month at the BFI South Bank. The most recent show was so packed we've divided it into two separate podcasts, the second of which will be up here in a few weeks' time. For this week, our special guests are Edgar Wright, talking about A Very Guilty Pleasure, and the brilliant Leslie Manville on her new movie, Ordinary Love. So sit back and enjoy MK3D live from the South Bank.
Moving on to the first of our guests, there is a film which is coming out in a week's time, which I went to Belfast to do the Belfast premiere for, called Ordinary Love, which I just think is wonderful. Here's the trailer for Ordinary Love, which is premiered in Belfast just last weekend and opens here next week.
There isn't a moment I won't be there with you.
It's an ebb and a flow.
Any particular style today, madam?
It suits you.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Too hot.
Tea cozy.
No.
Isn't it so?
I had this feeling that if I can get through it all, it would somehow change me. I don't think it has. I don't think I want it to.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show Leslie Manville. I have to start by saying thank you for fitting us into your busy schedule, because once you've finished here, you're rushing off to go and do a BAFTA screening. And I left you alone in the green room for 5 minutes, and I came back and Boyd Hilton was giving you an award. What did you just win?
I just won Heat Magazine Television Actress of the Year.
So tell us about Ordinary. I mean, I think it's a really powerful film. It's directed by Glenn and Lisa, who made Good Vibrations, which I absolutely love to pieces. David Holmes has done the music for us. Tell us about the film.
Well, it's written by an Irish playwright called Owen McCafferty, who hadn't written a film before. And Lisa and Glenn, our two directors, encouraged him to write this film, which it's no secret, is based on him and his wife's mm-hmm. story. His wife, Peggy, went through breast cancer and came out of it the other side, thankfully. So he felt close enough to it, with her permission, obviously, to write about it. And then they came to me with it, and Liam was on board. So I thought, I don't really like my leading man, so he's going to have to go. but it's quite a hard film to sell when you have to try and sell it, because, I mean, yes, it's about a couple who have had, and I won't say what it is because it's a bit of a spoiler, they've had an earlier tragedy in their married life, and they are now their lives have closed down a bit. And they've become content, and they love each other, and they fancy each other, and they laugh together. But their lives are very regular, very ordinary. And then they have to deal with this cancer that she gets, and in a way, that's it. I mean, that, but it monitors how this monumental thing that happens to so many people's lives now, how you handle it, how you deal with it, what it does to even the strongest and closest of relationships, and just the subtle things that it does, really. And but it's also a film about, it's also a middle-aged love story, mm-hmm. which is a good thing to have on screen, because everyone over 20 thinks that we don't do it anymore once we're over 50. And it's not true.
Well, one of the interesting things about the title of the film is now Ordinary Love. When the script began life, it was Normal People.
Yes.
And when Owen McCafferty was on stage in Belfast, he said that he really liked Ordinary Love because it is a love story. But he also liked the fact that Normal People told you that what the story is about is everyone else around. It focuses on a central couple, but it's everyone else around them. And it's this idea that this is something that kind of everybody goes through a version of this. And I thought that was really powerful. I think that the way in which it depicts the treatment itself is, if anyone has any experience of it, it's very, very accurate. But it's about their relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That is the key thing. And I actually think Ordinary Love is a better title because it... I mean, a Normal People, obviously, we couldn't use it because of the novel. So... I just think to get the word love in it mm-hmm. is quite important, really.
Yeah. I want to show a clip from the film itself, because one of the things that's really lovely about the film is it's very funny. And when it played at Belfast, there was loads of laughter in the audience, and very sort of. But David Holmes, who was one of the producers and the composer, said it's interesting that in different areas people are uncertain as to whether they're allowed to laugh at the jokes. And what was lovely in the Belfast audience was they absolutely did. Mm. So this is it's just a little scene, but I think it demonstrates some of what you're talking about, and also how the humour is very, very important through the film. Here's a little clip.
How long did they say you'd be in for?
Well, at least a week. Got to make sure that the wound's clean and under my arms are all drained. Or...
Mm. Do you need me to bring anything up?
Yeah. can you go into the top drawer and get my blue nightdress, make sure it's the blue one because the other one's a bit grubby, and some knickers.
Any type? Crotchless?
Don't make me laugh, it hurts.
Not the crossless, then. Sturdy gusset.
Sturdy gusset. Couple of face cloths as well.
Anything else? Any other things that aren't sexually romantic?
No, just the sexually romantic stuff.
Yeah, I think that's important. That it's good that you've said that it's funny, because it. I think that I've had a lot of people, obviously, who've been through cancer, talk to me about the film, and they really like that about it. That it's not. I mean, Joan and Tom, the characters in it, are a glass half full couple, aren't they? But they're not. It's not all downbeat, you know.
They also have a lovely kind of... there's a very affectionate bickering in their relationship. And we saw a little bit of it when they have the discussion about, you know, I want tomato juice. Well, why don't you just get tomatoes? Well, tomato juice isn't the same as tomatoes. And she says, well, why don't you get a juicer? And he says, well, I wouldn't use it. And she says, well, you're not using enough. He says, hang on, we're having an argument about a juicer that we don't have, that I don't... And I think that's really well observed character stuff about the way they tell each other they love each other is by having these kind of strange little arguments.
Yes, and it is the stuff of life. Isn't it? It's the stuff of all our lives. We all have to shop, and so I mean, I've always had a theory. You know, if you've got to do all this ordinary stuff in life, you might as well do it with some humour and with a bit of fun, because it's easy to push the trolley around like that, but then you can push it around and you know, be a bit more open to a bit of a gag occasionally.
What's it like being directed by two people? Because Lisa and Glenn, so they have very clearly defined roles. Is that right?
Yes, they do. I mean, Lisa really directed Liam and I and the other actors, and Glenn kind of, he's always there, and they go off and talk together, and you don't feel that they're being in a club because they're doing that. It's just they're husband and wife, and they're collaborating, and they understand each other, and it's what they do best. But Glenn really was to do more with cameras and shots and, you know, design things. But it honestly, you wouldn't want... It would be bad news if both of them were coming up and maybe giving conflicting notes. That wouldn't be good. So that just didn't happen.
So what was the atmosphere like on the set? Because obviously, you know, you're dealing with... Some of the subject matter is heavy, but the dialogue is... As I said, there is a lot of laughter, a lot of levity in it. Mm. Even, you know, in some of the characters whose situation is, you know, is terminal, there is a lot of laughter.
Yeah. Yes. It was a really lovely, good atmosphere on set. And the great thing about all the scenes with the technicians, the nurses, the chemo nurses, and all of that, those were real people. And that was, well, it was very humbling and also very useful, because they would talk me through exactly what it would be like and what would happen and how you'd be feeling. But the chemo nurse in particular, I mean, we just got talking, and I was talking about one of my sisters who'd been through breast cancer, and she was talking about her life, and her life was really quite difficult and quite hard. Mm-hmm. But her job, so I said, well, how do you manage this then? How do you manage this job that you're administering this horrible drug to people on a daily basis? And she said, but it's my job to make them feel better. And it was just so inspiring and terrific on a practical level, because she said by the third course or second course, that's when the vomiting kicks in, and then this, when your hair starts to go. And
Is that? Did you shave your head, or is that are you wearing a prosthetic?
No, I couldn't shave my head because I would have done, but I had to come back and do Mum, and she wasn't bald at the end of series two. But even if I'd have been willing to do it, it wouldn't have worked really, because you have to have all the stages.
Yeah.
So if I'd have shaved it, then the next day we might have needed to do a scene when it's that growing back, or the scene when Tom cuts her hair, and it's...
Yeah.
So there was all the... So I actually had 11 different bald caps and stages of
They are
growth.
Brilliantly done, because I've seen the film a few times.
Can't
now,
see
like,
the joint.
No, literally couldn't see the joint.
You didn't
at
see
all.
That big stocking at the back. That was tied up.
The other thing that I think is lovely about it is that the course of the narrative is that the couple begin together, and then they are sort of separated by what's happening, and then they're sort of brought back together again. And so there is that lovely arc, but there is a point in the middle of it when they are sort of separated from each other. And I think it's equally good at getting the sitting around in waiting rooms as to what's happening to your character.
And the loneliness of it. You know, I mean, Tom says to Joan, I'm going to be with you every step of the way. And he is there. Their lives are very interdependent. But for me, what came through as an observer of the film is how lonely being ill on that level must be when you're looking at, you know, a scenario that isn't the one you expected or wanted. The loneliness of it, that however much you're in a great relationship and however supported you are, you're alone.
Yeah.
So I think the film depicts that very well.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's accurate in when it needs. I mean, there's a moment in it in which you hear the sound of the machine that takes out the sample tissue. But I think what's great is that. Is that there is, you believe in the characters, you believe in their life, and even in the way in which they deal with grief and, you know, whatever is in their past is very, very sort of naturally portrayed. Working with Glenn and Lisa, who are this, I mean, I only know them, you know, from interviewing them as filmmakers, and they seem really, really lovely. They seem genuinely kind of... Now, you've worked, and I'm not saying it isn't, you've worked many times with Mike Lee. I imagine it's a very, very different experience with the Mike Lee process, right?
Well, the whole process with Mike is so different. I mean, with this, you know, it's a bit more conventional. You get the script, yeah. You work on it. We worked, the four of us, Glenn, Lisa, Liam and I, and, you know, you do it like that. With Mike, it's so different. And Maxine might talk about that later too, because she's worked with him. But it's such a protracted process. Yeah. You know, you work for months on your own with him, creating a character. I think a lot of people think that you just kind of turn up on day one and start improvising and see what happens. And they also think that you shoot that in that way, that you just roll the camera and see what happens. I mean, you know, nothing is further from the truth. I mean, it's more meticulous once you've arrived at it than any other film that I've made. It's down to the letter, to the full stop, to the comma.
Yeah.
But it's just the process of getting to that's very, very different. But I think that Mike, I think where you're coming from is that Mike has his own relationship with press and journalists. But on the day, in the room, he loves actors and he's very... he's very good with us, and he makes it the best experience for us.
Well, no, I should be. I mean, I've had really, you know, lovely conversations with Mike. I mean, he's tough when he needs to be tough, and he's come on the show here, and he's been great fun. But I have asked him the same question so many times. I said, "Explain to me your process." And every time
we've only got to half past
exactly.
eight, haven't
and
we?
Every
we
time I do, it, and actually, the best answer he ever gave me was. He said, the thing is, what you have to understand is, he said, firstly, he said, I love comedy, and people don't see that, you know, enough. They don't see the laughter. And he said, and secondly, you see the finished product, right? And he said, if you get a Hoover or something, you wouldn't say, how was it put together? You just go, okay, it works as it is. And so what you're saying was that you cannot understand this because you're not an actor. And I think that's true.
Yeah, yes. And I think also that what we arrive at when we shoot his films is, we don't ever have it written down, but that's a kind of detail.
Yeah, yeah.
But you do arrive at a script, because you can't shoot a film unless there is one. You can't get the continuity right, et cetera, et cetera. So we arrive at that. It's just that if you said to a writer, how long did it take you? If you said to Owen, how long did it take you to write Ordinary Love? And he said, a year, 2 years, nobody would think, oh, that's... Yeah, that's maybe a bit long, but okay, that's how long it took you. I mean, we do start on day one with Mike, except for his historic films,
yeah,
like
sure.
Peterloo and Topsy Turvy and all of that. We start with nothing. I mean, he has notions and ideas and themes, and he has to cast it, so he sort of knows if somebody's going to be a brother or a son. But he actually doesn't really know where it's going to go. So the fact that we do it in about 6 months on average is not bad going. But of course, he's doing it not on his own in a room.
Yeah.
He's doing it in collaboration with these actors. And by the time we've created these characters in a completely three-dimensional way, you then can put us into improvisations, into all sorts of situations, and you just fly because you know how that person's going to behave. And the dialogue comes from you, from the actor. I mean, yes, he then takes all that dialogue and sorts it out and puts it in the right place, and so that it isn't repetitive and boring and all of those things. But the words come from us. So the whole process of creating the what becomes the script that we shoot is a collaboration, and it's just a different way of doing it.
I think it's astonishing. I have nothing but admiration for that method of filmmaking, not least because it's like astrophysics. I remember interviewing Tim Spall, and I said, you know, how did you get into Turner? He said, well, I had to learn everything that Turner knew.
Yes.
It's like, what do you mean? He said, yeah, I had to like literally learn about light, and I just think it's an astonishing process. I want to ask you also about, you worked with Paul Thomas Anderson on Phantom Thread. You were Oscar nominated. Should have won, and it's an absolutely brilliant role. I want to show one of my favourite clips from Phantom Thread, and I want to ask you a little bit about it afterwards. Have a look at this.
Is there something I'm unaware of? Because as far as I can remember, all I have done is to dress her beautifully.
I don't think that matters to some people. I think they want what is fashionable and chic.
Chic? Oh, don't you start using that filthy little word, chic. Whoever invented that ought to be spanked in public. I don't even know what that word means. What is that word? Fucking chic? They should be hung, drawn, and quartered. Fucking chic.
It shouldn't concern you.
It does concern me. It concerns me very much, Cyril, because it's hurt my feelings. It's hurt my feelings.
So what's all this moaning about?
I am not moaning. I do not like to be turned away from.
Nobody does. But I don't want to hear it because it hurts my ears.
That's the best line in the film. That's the best line in the film. So how was that? How was making Phantom Thread?
God, honestly, it was probably the best 14 weeks of my career. Yeah. It was heaven. I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson is... He's not just wonderful and makes films that you just... I mean, I love his films. I'm sure you do too.
Total fanboy, sorry.
But he's just... Going to work with him every day is just joyous. It's just... He's just a lovely, funny, gorgeous person to be in a room with all day. I had the script 7-8 months before we started. And he was not prescriptive about it at all. It wasn't, she needs to be this, she's that. He just gave it to me, there it was, and he just left it with me to stew for 7 months. I mean, we met during that time, and I had copious amounts of costume fittings, obviously, because it's all about fashion. But he left me on my own. So, I turned up and you start doing it, and then he absolutely comes alive. So, little things I did, like when I took off, because her hair's always neat like that, when she took her glasses off, like little wispy bits of hair might come out. So I'd take the glasses off and then tidy the hair, and he loves it, loves it. And then he runs with that, and then he wants to do it, and he plot when he wants to maybe do that again. And you just start to do stuff, little things, and he notices it all. And then he'll start to make decisions of how he'll shoot things. And then there's another shot of Cyril walking down the hallway quite early on in the film. Simple shot, you could have shot it from behind and it wouldn't have been that interesting. But it's her opening the door, this neat, precise world that they're in, opening the door to start the day the princess is arriving for her fitting. But he did the complete down the barrel, looking down the lens, right down the lens. And it was something he'd seen his great friend Jonathan Demme do. And oddly enough, Jonathan died, and they were very close, mm-hmm. Paul and Joe. He died on the final day of our shoot.
Isn't the film dedicated to him?
Yes, it is, yeah. Yeah, but he, two such different rooms to be in, his room and Mike Lee's room and Lisa and Glenn's room, but amazing. And I want to be flexible. If I'm not in a room with an idiot, which most of the time I'm not, why wouldn't I go, okay, let me bring what I'm going to bring and you bring what you're going to bring, and hopefully we'll make the best of both of us.
Let me ask you an honest question. No names, no pack drill, right? So, Paul Thomas Anderson, Mike Lee, Lisa and Glenn, have you ever been in a room with an idiot? Have you ever made a film with somebody you just thought, you don't know what you're doing?
Hell yeah. Oh God, yes, yeah, lots.
And how do you get through it?
Well, because I've got enough experience to wing it by myself, and I can wing it by myself, but it's not very pleasurable. Yeah. I want collaboration. I want help. I mean, if I can come up with something on my own, I can work it out at home and. But it's boring. It's boring doing that. And actually, directors that aren't bringing anything to the table when they've got decent actors in the room shouldn't be doing it.
I think you're fabulous.
Thank you.
just quickly before you, I know you have to rush off to BAFTA to get some other adulation. You're on stage very soon. What are you doing?
I'm doing The Visit just across the road at the National Theatre. It's Tony Kushner's version of a 1950s play written by Frederick Durenmat, and it's about revenge, and I play the world's richest woman. There you go.
Fantastic. So that's
have I sold it?
You have, and that's from January?
The very end of January.
Very end of January. Well, we look for, you know, maybe if, you know, when you're in the middle of award season and Ordinary Love is winning everything, you will persuade you to come back on the show. It's such a pleasure. I really, really love Ordinary Love, not least because of, as I said, and I mean this in the best possible way, because of how funny it is, which I think is a really, really important thing. And I think it is a love story, along with everything else. Please join me in thanking the fabulous Leslie Manville.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's guilty pleasure time. it's one of the funny things with guilty pleasure is that we've been doing it for a while, and with it, every now and then people say, well, you know, we should probably lose guilty pleasure because, you know, nobody's really guilty about anything. But I got to tell you, this week's guilty pleasure, you know. You remember when Alan Jones came on and did Grease 2? Nothing. You remember when Ben Wheatley came on and did Zardoz? Nothing. I'm so pleased that my next guest is here because I've been trying to get him on the show for ages because he's just unbelievably busy. Director of Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, The World's End, Edgar Wright! Edgar, welcome to the... I'm so glad you're here.
Thanks for having me.
You are the world's hardest working film... Two films editing at the moment.
Yes.
Which are?
One is my next, like, sort of fiction feature, which is called Last Night in Soho. And I'm also doing my first documentary about the band Sparks. I've never done two things at the same time. I'm not sure I would recommend doing two things at the same time, but that is what I'm doing.
And the feature stars...
Feature stars Thomasin McKenzie,
who's so brilliant in Leave No Trace,
and Anya Taylor-Joy,
who's so brilliant in The Vavitch,
and The Vavitch, and Matt Smith,
yeah,
from Doctor Vavu.
Doctor Vavu, yes.
So yeah, I'm working on that at the moment.
What kind of story is that?
It is, I guess it's like a psychological horror. I've always wanted to do like a straight horror film. I guess Shaun of the Dead is obviously partly in that territory. But I wanted to do like a psychological horror film or a straight horror film. I also wanted to do something that was set in central London. You know, I've made films in London before, but they've usually been in the suburbs or, yeah, you know, kind of, you know, outside the North Circular. And I spend so much time in Soho, like working and living as well in Soho and Fitzrovia, that I just wanted to make something that was in the centre. Because I felt like it was an area of London that since the 60s and 70s doesn't appear on the screen that much. Mm-hmm. Partly because it's really difficult
hard
to film
it. Yeah, yes.
In fact, well, of course, the Phantom Thread is like mostly in
Fitzrovia. Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, absolutely. So do you live here or do you live... Because every time I try and get in touch with you, you're in LA or you're in here, you know, or you were in Atlanta when you were doing Baby Driver. I mean, how often are you actually here? Comes a Friday, you don't call, you don't write. You know.
I've never left London. I have actually been here most of like the last year. In fact, I was in this very theatre like all day yesterday because I watched three Bob Fosse films in a row.
Oh, wow, well, part of the musical season.
Did anybody else do that yesterday?
Which three did you?
You did. I recognise you.
Which three did you watch?
Sweet Charity,
great.
Cabaret, and All That Jazz.
Yeah, so, okay, and
which in a row is quite like you know, Overwhelming. Okay. But it was amazing.
Controversial decision. Which is the best of those three?
Well, I mean, they're all great.
Go on.
I love Sweet Charity.
Oh, okay.
I love Sweet Charity. But, I mean, All That Jazz is also incredible. No?
No. Well, the thing is, I mean, they are all
brilliant. They're all amazing.
No, they are all absolutely brilliant. I think All That Jazz is I mean, I love Cat, but I think All That Jazz is such a masterpiece.
It's
I think
amazing.
Roy Scheider going, Shota, it's just fantastic. And All That Jazz was the first time I saw a musical in which I thought this is really psychedelic, and you know, the whole I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And then,
I mean, they're all great, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so we asked you to do two things, one of which was guilty pleasure. I also said, look, you know, inspirational movies. We asked you to choose one movie that changed your life. You came up with five. These five, yeah. And then you added one, which was Evil Dead 2.
Yes.
Yeah. So if go back one still to the five, Nick. Okay, so briefly...
Well, I think
So there's Carrie, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, American Werewolf in London, Raising Arizona, and Driver. I mean, Driver, obviously, you know, Baby Driver.
Direct influence.
Yeah, direct influence.
And I'd say American Werewolf in London is like, a very, tonally at least, a very big inspiration on Shaun of the Dead, for sure. But it's also one of those films, American Werewolf in London, I saw it, I think when it was first on the BBC, when I was like 10 years old, and my parents had let me and my brother stay up to watch it because they would let us stay up and watch things that were like a 15 or an 18 if they had a fantasy element to them.
Oh, okay.
Because American Werewolf in London was a werewolf movie and it had special effects in it. We were allowed to stay up. And then I was watching it with my parents, and then when it got to the scene where David Norton has his throat slit by Nazi monsters, my mum said, okay, that's enough, bed. And I was sent to bed, and then I had the worst nightmares. Because if you're going to let your kids watch a horror film, at least let them watch the ending.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because if you don't see them, the evil vanquished in some way, then I was left with horrible, horrible nightmares until I saw the rest of the film
about
2 years later.
The end of American Werewolf is Soho, isn't it? It's the Eros cinemas right in the very centre of Piccadilly.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was, you know, when you look at that film now, it's sort of astonishing what he managed to get away with. I mean, I don't think anybody could shoot that Piccadilly Circus scene today.
No.
They wouldn't let you do it.
No, absolutely. And it's brilliant. I mean, it really has a tangible sense of place, and you know, which is one of the things I love about it. So, these are the things that inspired me, plus Evil Dead 2. Incidentally, why Evil Dead 2 rather than Evil Dead?
Oh, it's just, I think, the humour element of it. I love Evil Dead 1 as well. And also, Evil Dead 1 as a... I think when I saw Jonathan Ross did that documentary on Channel 4, The Incredibly Strange Film Show, and I think I'd always been interested in doing films, but it wasn't until watching his documentary about Sam Raimi and realizing that he was like an 18-year-old who had made Super 8 films at school and then had just made a film and didn't know anybody. There was no nepotism. You know, I used to think that like directors, wrongly, I used to think that sort of directors had been dropped off by a stork at Universal Studios, and that's how they started directing, or everybody was the son of somebody, and then you see other stories, you're thinking, oh, so he's just like a guy in, you know, Detroit, and he just starts making movies with his school friends, and I think that, more than anything, was the thing that I thought, I want to do that. Yeah. So that was the real sort of, touch paper for me, okay. I guess.
So look, those are good choices. And then I said guilty pleasure. And here's the weird thing. When you said your guilty pleasure, at first I thought, oh, that's interesting. I'd forgotten how bad it is. Tell us what your guilty pleasure is.
Well, one thing I said before this, I get conflicted about guilty pleasures because I think maybe about 10 years ago, I used to sort of make more fun of like bad movies and even like screen them sometimes. And the thing is that if you make films, you shouldn't really make fun of other people's films because nobody sets out to make a bad movie. However,
well,
but also I think sometimes, especially when you work in the industry, if you make fun of a movie in any public way, you'll always run into somebody who had something to do with it. Huh. And so, but also guilty pleasures is like the thing about this movie is it is like much of it is not good. And then there are moments that are like, that I find quite creepy. And here's the thing, the reason I picked this as a guilty pleasure is that I had me and Joe Cornish, the director, and also I've written with. We're sort of both obsessed with this movie. And then I went to see it at the cinema in Los Angeles, and I took a bunch of friends kind of thinking it would be a laugh riot. And even though there are some very unintentionally funny bits, there are also some bits that are really creepy. And so I kind of came away sort of feeling, well, this is the definition of a guilty pleasure, because it's not 100% bad. There are moments in it where, as inept as the rest of it is, it every now and again it scores a bullseye. And then there are other scenes which are just beyond the pale. So the movie is Michael Winner's The Sentinel, which is... Michael Winner, I guess this is made in the wake of The Exorcist and The Omen, around the time when big studios are making...
Satan movies.
And also movies with big stars in them, mm-hmm. and expensive movies. They're like studio movies, but everybody's trying to replicate the success of The Exorcist. And The Sentinel is like trying its absolute darndest to be that. And, you know, it was made in 1977. And, you know, it has an all-star cast. It's like... Well, have you got? Do you want to show the trailer?
We should see the trailer because I think the trailer definitely sets the. How many people have seen The Sentinel? A smattering, I think. Okay, welcome to The Sentinel.
It's one of the nicer tree-lined blocks in New York, and only 20 minutes from the center of town. Oh, and just around the corner there's a supermarket, and the cleaners. That's Father Heron in 5A. He's blind.
Blind? Well, then what does he look at?
There is danger everywhere. There is evil. Evil everywhere. Turn around, Allison. Look behind you. There is horror. There is darkness.
I think Allison may die.
But watching, waiting, warding off evil... There is hope. The Sentinel.
Before Halloran, there was Father David Spinetti. Before him, Mary Thorin becomes Sister Mary Angelica.
Father Matthew Halloran dies the same day that Allison Parker disappears and becomes Sister Teresa.
I like the specificity in the voiceover. It says, "Turn around, Allison."
No, yes. Everyone else, keep looking straight ahead.
Only Allison is in danger.
Also, I mean, very early Christopher Walken, uncredited Christopher Walken, so much so that he's not even mentioned in the list.
And Jeff Goldblum as well, and Beverly D'Angelo as well.
Jeff Goldblum's in two winners, isn't he? Because he's in Death Wish
is one.
Is
of
he
the...
Death Wish or Death Wish Two?
Death Wish One,
because he's one of the people that break into the apartment in his early thug role. Okay, so. Tell us what you like about it.
Well, this is the thing. When I went to see it me and my friend Joe became sort of obsessed with it, and with a couple of scenes, One of which we're going to play. And then when I did see it at the cinema, I took a bunch of friends and I thought, oh, this is going to be a camp classic. And there are bits that really like unintentionally funny. And then there are bits that are genuinely creepy. And there's that thing with like, and it's that funny, I would never like, it's easy, Michael Winner has a sort of reputation in this country of somehow being the world's worst director, but he's not. Like every now and then, the sad thing about Michael Winner is that some of his films, you know, there's bits of them that are good. He did have some talent and then he kind of just like, you know, sort of, has got zero subtlety in other places. And so for everything that's kind of good, there's something that's really bad that ruins the whole thing. But then there are moments in this film that are genuinely quite creepy. There's like makeup by Dick Smith, who did The Exorcist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And The Godfather and Little Big Man and, you know, yeah.
And it's also impossible to, with that cast as well, it's like, that's the amazing thing is Michael Winner would attract these massive casts.
He worked with Marlon Brando in Night Company. He worked with everybody.
Yeah, all-star cast. So that's the thing that I like about it is it's genuinely sort of entertaining. And I think the thing is, I only think the only truly bad movie is a boring movie. Mm-hmm. If a movie is entertaining in any regard, then it can't actually be a bad movie, I don't think. I think the only bad movies are boring movies, and The Sentinel is not boring. And also, the other thing that's interesting about it is it's clearly like they ripped off the plot of The Sentinel in Ghostbusters. Like, the whole kind of plot line for, like, Azul and, like, the gatekeeper is kind of basically Christina Rain's plot line from this movie. It's the idea of this haunted apartment block where her apartment is the gateway to hell, and all the denizens of hell are going to come through her apartment. Is like basically Ghostbusters just kind of and pasted that straight into their screenplay.
Ghostbusters done by Michael Winner. in that trailer, one of the things that got the biggest laugh in, which is he says there is evil, and it cuts to a cat wearing a party hat. I feel it's necessary to show that scene.
Okay. And then I have a story about that exact scene.
Just
as well.
Before we play it, what the hell is going on?
So in this scene, I guess this scene is like this, you know, this is, it's a real like sort of like hodgepodge of things stolen from like The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby as well. And particularly she has these, Christina Raines is a model who moves to Manhattan and gets this kind of amazing apartment in this brownstone. And why is it so cheap? Well, the reason it's so cheap is because it's haunted, this place. And eventually there's John Carradine plays this priest who's living on the top floor, who's the sentinel, who's the only person stopping the denizens of hell of coming into our domain. So when John Carradine dies, it's kind of Christina Raines is going to become the sentinel. So in this scene, she has these kooky neighbors, not dissimilar to the kooky neighbors in Rosemary's Baby. And what you find out later, spoiler alert, that these people are not alive. They are the ghosts of serial killers. So, but this scene, so that's number one thing. The number two thing about this scene is when she goes around to their apartment, they're having a birthday party for their cat. This is the scene.
Good.
Everybody, now tune up your voices.
Black and white cat, black and white cake.
Ready.
Happy birthday, dear Jezebel. Happy birthday to you.
I have a funny story about that scene, if I can go off on a quick
You
tangent.
Can. I just say that he's definitely unfilmed a Michael Winner. That is,
I want to. I don't. I'd love to know how he got the cat to stay still for that long. Was the cat nailed to that chair? I don't know how the cat stayed still for that whole scene.
I really enjoyed the reaction shots. Anyway, so.
This is a tangential story, and this involves some name-dropping, but it is worth it. So myself and Joe Cornish are obsessed with this movie, and particularly this scene, and also the line, black and white cake. And so it's Joe Cornish's 40th birthday, and at the time when it was his 40th birthday, we were writing on Tintin for Spielberg, Steven Spielberg. sorry.
Sorry. I think you dropped this, Edgar. Sorry.
I didn't call him Steven. Anyway, so it was Joe's birthday. I was in Los Angeles, and Joe was still in London, and we were doing this script conference by Skype, and it was Joe's 40th that day, and I had got, as a present for him, Steven Spielberg to sign a Raiders of the Lost Ark poster for Joe's 40th, and then also, actually, Leo, who I never met him, but Leo, who I work with, I got in touch with my agent and said, hey, do you think I could get Michael Winner to sign a Sentinel poster? And so I got a Sentinel quad poster. This one, well, this one, actually. Well, not the French one, but I got like an English one. And Leo, who I work with, went round to Michael Winner's house and was forced to have breakfast with him. That's the best part of the story. And then I said, will Michael Winner sign the poster, black and white cat, black and white cake, which he did. So then cut to, it's Joe's birthday, and we've just finished this conference, and Spielberg has got, I say, hey, can I use the Skype after the meeting? Because I want to give Joe his presents. And I had tucked the presents in the room that he was in London. So they were like behind him and he didn't know. Everybody else had gone, so Spielberg had gone, but Kathleen Kennedy, the super producer, decided to stay behind. She goes, I want to see Joe open his present, because she was aware that he got this Raiders poster. So Joe's opening his presents, and he opens the Raiders one. He goes, oh, my God, that's amazing. And Kathy's there going, and then he opens the other one. He goes, oh, my God, how did you get this? And I could see afterwards, Kathy Kennedy, she says, what was the other present? And I said, I got Michael Winner to sign the poster for the Sentinel. And her bemused expression of why that was better than the Raiders poster has always stayed with me. the other things about this movie, like, it did inspire something that I've done. I don't know if you want to share this clip or not. I don't know if you even have it, but like, I did. Do you want to show the Don't trailer?
Yeah, we
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because partly because we included it in our Secrets of Cinema special.
Oh, you did. That, yeah. I was very...
you want to tell us what it is before we watch it?
Maybe about 12 years ago now, Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez did this film. Sorry, just... I didn't say Quentin. They did a movie called Grindhouse.
I was with Friedkin, Billy Friedkin, the other day.
They did a double bill called Grindhouse. It was two different movies, and in the middle were fake trailers, and they asked me to do a fake trailer for a horror movie that did not exist. So my idea was to do like a Euro horror, and it was inspired by things like The Sentinel, where if you just looked at The Sentinel trailer, you have no idea what the fuck it's about. And that was sort of the thing. It's like, and a lot of those Euro horror films, like things like, I'm sure, a movie that you love called Living Dead at the Manchester Mall.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is also in other countries called, like, Do Not Speak Ill of the Dead or Let Sleeping Corpses Lie. Very evocative titles. But in the States, it's called Don't Open the Window. and there's no window scene in the movie. So I thought I would do... Well, you'll see. This is it. So this, and you, as you see, as in the Sentinel trailer, which said, from the frightening bestseller, I replicated that part. Based on the terrifying bestseller.
I got to tell you, that trailer saved us 10 minutes of screenwriting for Secrets of Cinema. We just went, that! There we go. Anyway, moving on. So, look, Edgar, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, I do think The Sentinel is remarkably bad.
If there's probably going to have time, but I did bring Michael Winner's autobiography to tell a story about The Sentinel, but only if we have...
Yeah, go on. Okay, I'm going to indulge you, okay?
I'll just tell the story and I'll let him speak. So the other thing, and to really bring the tone down... by the way, before you watch this with your family or anything, there are some really lurid scenes in it. I mean, it's also infamous for like a really like terrible...
Yeah. Really, really, yeah.
And then the other thing that's really bad about it is that at the end of the movie, the denizens of hell come into the apartment and Michael Winner, with glorious subtlety, decided to cast... people with physical deformities.
Yeah.
And this is him discussing this in his autobiography. At the end of the Sentinel script, there was a line which read, "The denizens of hell come through the walls of the house and besiege our heroine." It was a reasonably budgeted film, but we didn't have enough makeup. We didn't have enough to make up 50 people in prosthetics every day, which takes about 6 hours for each person. We'd have needed 20 makeup men, so I decided to use genuinely deformed people. My assistants gathered a group of the most amazingly deformed people. They were all very nice human beings. These are Michael Winner's words, not mine. Later on, I got press cuttings when many of them went back to different parts of America, and the cuttings all had one theme, that the person who was deformed said how wonderful it was to be on the movie and in the company of other people who were deformed because we realized we were not alone in the world. We were filming a large house in Brooklyn overlooking the Hudson River where I sensed something odd was going on. There seemed to be additional people on set and gossiping. I said to my assistant director, "What's happening?" Charlie Oakham said, "Trade union representatives from the camera union and from the Directors Guild are here. The crew have phoned them because they object to having lunch with the freaks. They want to put a screen up outside so they don't have to look at them during lunch." I said, "I've never heard anything so disgraceful in my life. These people have been disadvantaged by God. They're terrific. terrific people. We're working with them on set all day. Don't tell me these brawny New York technicians are so frail they'll fall to pieces if they have to see them for an extra hour during lunch. I'm ashamed of everybody. Charlie says, be that as it may, Mr. Winner, I've got a screen going up. The freaks will eat on one side of the screen, we'll eat on the other. I said, Charlie, do you realise how disgraceful this is? I want to tell you something. I'm coming to lunch today and I'm going to sit with the freaks to show my view of this matter. Charlie Oakham said, what are you complaining about, Mr. Winner? You never eat with the crew. You eat in your own private air-conditioned room in the house. I'll bet that's where you have your lunch today. Now, this is where the story could get a lot better here,
there's
but it doesn't.
More?
He says, to my endless and great shame, Charlie was absolutely right. Come lunchtime, it was 95 degrees outside. It was cool and air-conditioned in my little room that I had for myself to relax in. That's where I had lunch. Disgraceful. That's the end of the story. It could have been... He could have lied in his autobiography and said that he showed solidarity and ate with them, but he didn't.
Wow.
And then when Joe got that autobiography signed by Winner, and he said he asked Michael Winner to sign it, always eat with the freaks. Anyway, check out the Sentinel tonight.
You know, I've been waiting for you to come on the show for ages, but you excelled even my expectations. Ladies and gentlemen...
I really let the sigh down after Leslie Manville, I'm sorry.
With the guiltiest of guilty pleasures, the great Edgar Wright.
Thank you.
Well, there we go. That's the first half of the most recent MK3D show recorded live at the BFI South Bank. The second half will be on the podcast in a few weeks' time. If you like the sound of the show, you'd like to come and see it live, then go to the BFI website. And if you'd like to hear this podcast without adverts, then why not visit our Patreon page? Thanks for listening. Tell your friends and keep watching the skies.
Into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener Salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save.